It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, Harambe, Pantsuit Nation, and Tweetstorm are all up for Word of the Year at the American Dialect Society. We'll hear more and maybe get your take.
First, Governor Walker had a busy day yesterday, including calling a special legislative session to address the state's opioid epidemic.
The governor also took time to talk about the need for more workers to fill open jobs. It's become a concern for employers, with the state's unemployment rate holding steady at 4.1% in November. That's below the national rate of 4.7% and a 15-year low for the state.
I just came from Green Bay thinking about the Packers on Sunday and winning and a good forecast. Those are all good vibes out there. But to use an example from the Packers, I can't afford to have anybody in the sidelines anymore. I got to get everybody in the game.
WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White was with the governor yesterday, and she joins us now from the Capitol. Laurel, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what was Governor Walker's main message about jobs yesterday?
Well, he used that kind of fun Packers metaphor to talk about the worker shortage in Wisconsin. And this has been a really consistent message that we've been getting from the governor since late last year, as he was kind of forecasting what his plans are for the next session. He's saying, my number one priority is workforce development. When I first took office, it was jobs, jobs, jobs. And now it's workforce, workforce, workforce.
And the governor had a bit more to say about that and the goals that he's working towards. Here's a taste of his other stuff.
Our goal is to find everyone a job in this state. Everyone has a place in our economy. And the best way we succeed is getting everybody off the sidelines. And then as we do that, that too will help us recruit more people.
So the governor had a lot to say yesterday about workforce and getting more people into the workforce. Laurel, who is he hoping to move into these open positions?
Well, you know, generally he said there's nobody in Wisconsin, if they're looking for a job, that shouldn't have a job. I want to find a job for everyone. Now, he did spend a little bit of time talking about specific populations. He talked about formerly incarcerated individuals, so people who've moving out of, you know, correctional institutions across the state, getting them employment. He also talked about disabled individuals and veterans as well, and kind of some specific plans that he has for getting those folks into the Wisconsin workforce.
Are the plans that he talked about yesterday markedly different from existing plans for job training?
They're really not. It sounds like he wants to expand upon things that are already in place. For example, with folks moving out of correctional institutions, there's a program that trains them to be certified nursing assistants. So he talked a little bit about that, expanding things like that, partnering with correctional institutions across the state to provide training. He talked about a program that offers internships to developmentally disabled individuals who are of high school age, that places them in institutions like the Milwaukee Zoo or Kalahari or hospitals to have some job experiences. So it sounds like he wants to just build upon things that are already in place. We aren't aware of anything incredibly new at this point, but of course this is very early in the process, so there could be some new things presented when he presents his budget next month.
So Laurel, does the fact that the governor is talking about workforce and creating a workforce to fill jobs, not talking about jobs themselves, indicate that he's kind of declaring victory on where jobs are in Wisconsin and moving on to a different aspect of that?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair characterization. I mean, I sort of alluded to this earlier, but he said his mantra used to be jobs, 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 and now it's workforce, workforce, workforce. So I think he is sort of declaring victory and saying we've got the openings out there. We just need people who are qualified to fill them. And it's not a small task. He said that that's going to be a big challenge to meet those needs. And so that's something that he wants to take on in the next session.
We're talking with Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, and she's with us to go over Governor Walker's plans for moving more Wisconsinites into the workforce. And one thing that came up that has been a topic in Wisconsin before, Governor Walker talked about wanting to drug test people who get welfare benefits. That's been blocked at the federal level. This is something that Governor Walker has broached with President-elect Donald Trump. So what did he say yesterday about that?
Well, it was a timely thing for him to mention yesterday because he was traveling around the state promoting some legislation, some plans that different folks have presented to tackle the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. So as he took the stage yesterday to talk to some bankers about the economic outlook of the state, he said, look, you know, drug dependency, abuse and addictions really have an impact on our workforce. And he said, I think his exact phrase was, if I can get you clean, I can get you a job. So he said, having this drug testing in place would actually help identify people who need treatment and worker training and get those folks jobs, employed, getting a steady paycheck. And he would argue that would keep them away from future substance abuse problems, I think.
Now, Republican Roberta Darling released a statement yesterday with another idea of how to make it easier for some people to join the workforce. What is she proposing?
Well, she's proposing, it's a very similar situation. She is asking the governor to ask for a federal waiver to create a sliding scale to reform the welfare system in Wisconsin. So, of course, that drug testing for welfare recipients is currently blocked by the federal government. The government says it's in violation of a federal law. So similarly, Senator Darling is asking the governor to reach out to the federal government and sort of get permission to make some changes to Wisconsin laws in regards to the welfare system. In this case, that sliding scale that she once created would gradually decrease benefits for folks who are receiving benefits so they don't decide perhaps not to take a raise at their job or pursue different employment because it would disqualify them for things, particularly childcare is something that she mentioned, that if they reach a certain income level, they're no longer able to receive that benefit, and it kind of prevents them from advancing in their career.
And is there any evidence so far that Alberta Darling's proposal is something that has buy-in from others, maybe on the Joint Finance Committee or others in the legislature?
Yes, several other legislators signed on to that. I believe a prominent lawmaker who signed on was the Assembly Speaker, Robin Voss. So, and this is certainly in line with what we were discussing before that the governor has sought from the federal government. So this is a fairly new thing as far as I know. So we'll probably hear as time goes by other lawmakers weighing in, the governor weighing in on this specific proposal from Senator Darling.
Now, we've heard a lot from the governor just this week, but did he give any indications about big picture what he'll be going over in the budget address, which is coming up soon, or next week's State of the State address?
That's right. So the State of the State is next Tuesday, and then the budget address will be sometime in mid-February. We don't have a date for that yet. The preview from him so far really points strongly to these workforce issues. So I think we're going to hear a lot from the governor, both in the State of the State, honestly, and in the budget address, about what he wants to do to increase things like worker training, dual enrollment programs, apprenticeships. He's talked about fab labs, which are those fabrication labs that are in high schools. So I think we're going to get quite a bit of focus on workforce development from the governor in the two big speeches that are coming up.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She was with us there to recap Governor Walker's plans for moving more Wisconsinites into the workforce.
Right now, we take a look back at 2016 with a look at words. The question on the table, which words embody the year 2016? Which were new and surprising and perfectly expressed a moment in history, or maybe a word or phrase that caught fire thanks to the cultural moment? You can join us with your votes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your word of 2016. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Grant Barrett joins us now. He's a co-host of Away with Words, which airs at 9 a.m. Sundays on Wisconsin Public Radio. And he's part of the American Dialect Society, which votes on the Word of the Year this afternoon. Grant, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey there. How you doing?
Doing well. So this is a bunch of kind of word nerds gathered together, and you get to hang out, have fun, and pick the word of the year. What is the debate been like so far?
It's very political, as you might expect in a political year where it seemed like everybody found somebody else to fight with. And so there's a lot of that. But the linguists tend to be good-natured people when it comes to this stuff, so it's a little bit of teasing back and forth.
And do presidential election years generate a language of their own? Do we see this every 4 years where there are these characteristic words or phrases that rise to the top?
Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. I think the most characteristic one would be Remember Chad, our good friend Chad, the hanging Chad.
From 2000, the, yep.
Dangling sometimes,
2000.
Yeah.
So every year there's some controversy. Some of it's real, some of it's manufactured. You know, one campaign will find something else and another campaign to pounce upon and make a big deal out of. This year had plenty of both real controversies and manufactured ones, and all of these generated language.
Grant, before we get into the words themselves, do these words, does it matter if they stick around, if they have staying power, or is it enough that they peaked in 2016?
It doesn't matter if they succeed. They've kind of done their job for now. They can be temporary. Each one of us, as English speakers, coins new words all the time. We do them momentarily. We'll put a prefix on, or we'll reduplicate a word, or we'll combine words, come up with a new compound, that sort of thing. And it need only serve its purpose for the moment. Chad is a really great example, which it hadn't been used in a regular way for more than 100 years. We used it furiously and with great energy in 2000, and ever since it's become a historical artifact again. And so I'm looking at the list of nominations this year, and I'm thinking some of these already show signs of success, that they'll be here a while, and many of them will just seem like quaint after effects of this election year of 2016.
What are some of the ones you see that may have that kind of staying power that are nominees this year?
Well, I think the word post-truth, or the compound post-truth, which refers to a period in our history when facts seem to matter less than they used to. I think that one already has shown that we're going to see books published about this. We're already seeing journal articles published about this. It's in coming from the pens and the keyboards of commentators. It's the kind of thing you might actually hear at a party or a family gathering. That one is really working. And the word fam, which is kind of short for not just your family, but like the squad of people that surrounds you, your crew, your posse. It's already got some history behind it, but it really had a nice spike in 2015 and 2016. That one will continue to be really useful slang that is going to be kind of hard to taint. You know, slang kind of feels stale and old after a while. Because I think fam is generic enough and general enough that it's going to be really hard to say, oh, yeah, we don't say that anymore. Anyway, that's my guess. It's always a fool's game to predict the future of language, but there you go.
I like the category most creative here. One of the favorites from the list, facticide. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so facticide is what it sounds like. It's the killing of facts or the distortion of facts. And that's really, it's obviously it depends on your perspective, politically or socially, what you think of fact is. But in some cases, it's where an obvious truth, something that can be defined by data or is shown to be true based on the experience of millions of people, is denied. But another group of people says, no, that's not the case, because I insist that it's not, or my opinion is that it's not. Therefore, I'm just going to ignore that fact, leave it out of my report, leave it out of my speech. And, it's about perspective in a lot of ways, but facticide is, it's happening. And so I think somebody thought it deserved a word, and here it is on the list.
Well, Donald Trump was the big political story of 2016, and I think one thing everybody can agree on, like him or not, he talked differently than most politicians. So did he drive in talking or via Twitter any of the nominees this year?
Oh.
Or most of the nominees.
Yeah, it's a lot of them. Some are about him and some are by him. I think a really great one, speaking as a linguist, is the word huge, which is huge, H-U-G-E, with a Y sound at the beginning instead of the aspirated H. And both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have this very standard dialect feature. There are large numbers of people, large number of Americans who say huge instead of huge. Even Terry Gross, if you listen to Fresh Air, she says huge.
So, Grant, we're from the Midwest here. Is this something that's an East Coast thing, saying huge?
It is not exclusively East Coast. It does appear often in the Northeast and in New England, but there are pockets of huge sayers around the country.
That is one I don't hear around here. Mm-hmm. No, huge, huge. Yeah, I can't think of anybody around here.
We could start trying it. I don't know.
Yeah, fit in with the times.
But it's best represented as huge with a lot of U's in the middle. Just mean that you really mean huge.
All right, what were some of the other Trumpisms or about Trump words that ended up nominated?
Well, I think a really great one is the discussion of tiny hands as a euphemism for someone's physical endowment, which came up in the debates. Trump's comment about Marco Rubio, and in turn, comments about Donald Trump that were originated by Spy magazine, I believe, in the 80s or 90s, where they called him a short-fingered vulgarian. And it's something he's really sensitive about because he thinks somebody saying that he has short fingers reflects on his potency as a man, his virility. And to have this come up in a national presidential debate is astonishing, and it has its own life now. It's kind of euphemistic secondhand to talk about what it means to be a man in politics. It's quite interesting. I think there are a lot of nightmares, or at least great sociological texts will be written about that.
We're talking to Grant Barrett right now, co-host of the public radio show Away with Words, looking at the nominees for the Word of the Year from the American Dialect Society. And Grant, not all of them were political words. There's a lot more of those we could talk about, but I want to talk about a few that are not. One of these had a lot of staying power, at least during 2016, Harambe.
Yeah, so here we've got this really sad story about a child that falls into a gorilla enclosure at the Cincinnati Zoo, and in order to protect the life of the child, this gorilla, Harambe, is shot. And it's so layered, multi-layered, where people thought that the family was to blame or that maybe the gorilla shouldn't have been shot. It became a good-natured meme. It became an ill-natured meme. It became highly offensive. A number of different images were spread around with the gorilla, just kind of ridiculous, and it almost had its own life, and we're talking websites and whole huge 4chan kind of conversation threads on this, and all over Reddit and Twitter. It's just really interesting how people will take this idea and run with it once it gets them a little bit of attention, and they think maybe it will get them a little bit more, but it's based upon a really sad story about an accident that happened and a family's life that was put in jeopardy, and a gorilla that had to be killed. It's really kind of horrific.
Taking nominations for the Word of the Year, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Grant, you're voting today. I don't want you to leak. I don't know if leak is one of the Words of the Year. That was a biggie, though, your favorite. But do you have some that are catching your eye that you think are worth voting for?
I'm always a fan of the ones that are kind of ordinary because I think they do have a chance of succeeding. People are now using, for example, chip as a verb. You know, a lot of bank cards rolled out chips now, so instead of swiping your card, you now chip your card. You put it right into the slot so that you can then punch in your information, your code. And those are great. Those are really, they're unremarkable. They're not particularly humorous or anything, but they do tend to last, and that kind of is where the majority of language change takes place.
And I'll say I like that one, Grant, because it serves a need, because every time I forget to use it and the counter says, oh no, you have to put the thing in the thing, and if they can have one word for that, you have to chip that, I think that's a very efficient use of language.
Yeah, it's super efficient, right? I think another one, because it's part 1 million of each generation coming up with its own words to mean great, good, or cool, is fire, F-I-R-E, as fire. An adjective. It's so fire. That outfit is fire on you. That's I don't know where it comes from, but here we have it. And it will last for a while, only to be replaced in a year or two by something else.
I like that one, too. I don't think it's hit Wisconsin Public Radio yet. No one has yet to say anything is fire. Have you heard that?
I have not, but I will
here
start
we are.
Using it.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Laura joining us in Green Bay. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to nominate?
Okay, so I have two teenagers in the house, so I've heard a whole plethora of words come forward this year. But one of the ones that I've heard the most, and now we've even started saying as parents, is slay.
Slay. As in, you really slayed out there today?
Yeah, it's being used as a verb. It's being, like, she slays, or you just slayed that. So it's kind of like, it's an empowering word in our house.
Laura, thanks. And you've got good taste. That is on the list, right, Grant?
Is it? I wasn't sure if it made the list. I know
it is. I've got it.
There it is. Yeah.
Yep.
That's right. This it's nominated as the slang word of the year. We have a bunch of different categories, and we've defined it as to succeed, be excellent, or amazing. The amazing thing about slay is that it is in no way new. I mean, it's decades old as a slang word, meaning particularly in show business, such as if you're a stand-up comic, if you slay, it means you performed really well. You killed them. You knocked them dead. You were great stuff.
And over the winter, we can slay a sleigh ride, maybe. Let's go to another caller now. Thanks, Laura. We'll go to Connie in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. Well, just what I was going to say is the word so, S-O, which the gal that was talking just before started out with so, and that was her first word. And I notice it all the time now.
This is a biggie, and it's a pet peeve for a lot of people, Connie. Thanks for that call. Grant, are you seeing the rise of the unnecessary so as the introduction of a sentence?
Well, it's not unnecessary. It's doing work. It's carrying a load. It's got a burden, and it's doing its job at the beginning of the sentence. Linguists have been tracking what we call sentence initial so for decades. It first appears in full force in the early 1980s. We think it might have come out of the Pacific Northwest, particularly the tech scene there. And you use it as a way to say, I'm about to explain something in a way that's kind of like a story that answers some questions that I know that you have. And if you listen carefully to news reports or interviews or any time that someone says so in that particular way, you'll find that it fits very nicely in that category.
I think that's one that's been around for a while. But, Grant, what about using it really quickly? We're almost out of time, but at the end of a sentence, as in I'm done talking, and then so, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, it's a form of politeness to say, I said all these things to you, but if you have any disagreement, I'm leaving an opening here for you to chip in with your opinion or to counteract what I said.
Grant, thank you so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both.
That's Grant Barrett, co-host of the public radio show Away with Words. Airs Sunday at 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about the word of the year. Grant's getting ready to cast his vote this afternoon.
Right now, it's time for Food Friday, and today we start with a riddle, courtesy of producer Carl Christensen, who is apparently part hobbit. He likes riddles. Here it is. I'll make your cake rise. I'll improve your best roast. But you'll really open your eyes when you pair me with toast. What am I?
Well, this is a tough one, except that I know that we're talking about butter this half hour. Elaine Kosrova joins us now. She's a former pastry chef and the author of the book Butter, A Rich History, which takes a detailed look at the culinary, scientific, and cultural history behind this everyday ingredient and shares some recipes as well. Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for that great tune that you played beforehand. I loved it.
The best in butter-themed music, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of us, I include myself, will take butter for granted. I use it. I cook with it. What inspired you to tackle it in this book?
Yes, I join you in that. You know, for most of my life, even as a pastry chef and also as a longtime food writer, I took butter for granted. But I was fortunate in my last job. I worked for a cheese magazine. I was fortunate to do a lot of traveling in the dairy world, and I got to try, of course, lots of cheeses, but many different kinds of butters, and to see the processing, and to really kind of step back and say, wow, the butter market has completely changed from say, 20 years ago in the States. You know, we have so many different brands, but also different kinds, you know, like higher-fat butters and cultured butters, whey butters, even goat butters and sheep butters, you know, different animal breeds that are giving us new kinds of butters. So that was really my inspiration, was kind of looking at the variety and wanting to understand the nuances between these butters. And then when I started to, you know, dig in and see the history that surrounded butter making, I was, you know, at that point I was sure there was a good book in this whole story between the science, the craft, and the history.
Well, Elaine, how far back does butter go?
Well, we'll never know precisely because it's well, well before recorded history, but we're pretty certain that it it aligns with domestication of animals, and it would have been most likely sheep and goat. Those would have been the first butters, not a cow's milk butter, because those were domesticated later. And at least 9,000 years ago. So the earliest recorded history is from 2500 B.C. with the Sumerians, because they actually have carvings on their temples that show butter making. So, you know, many thousands of years ago.
It always amazes me, these big food innovations. Do you think back and wonder, how did it occur to people to take this milk from an animal and churn it and do what they need to do and make this solid fat out of it? It seems like a big leap.
Yeah, most likely it was an accidental leap. We're pretty certain that some milk, whole rich milk, ended up in an animal skin, you know, being carried by a shepherd across the hill and, you know, down the valley. And through that rocking back and forth, we can surmise that butter was churned in that skin with the rocking. So when that shepherd got to his destination and opened the animal skin, you know, lo and behold, there's beautiful pieces of butter that I'm sure, you know, mystified him. And actually, butter making really was a mystery and kind of a magic for a lot of people up until, you know, a lot of producers up until the 1800s when we finally kind of teased apart what was going on. But, you know, it's when you think about it, it's like, you know, you have this liquid white milk and you shake it and you get these rich, beautiful morsels of fat, of golden fat. I mean, it's quite remarkable when you think about it.
These days we have these kind of seesaw arguments about whether butter is good for you or bad for you and whether you should be eating margarine instead of butter. But I imagine a long time ago, butter was prized because it was fatty and rich and it fortified you.
Very, very sustaining. And, you know, the tide is turning on fat. We've realized that being on a high-carb diet has kind of led us down the wrong road health-wise. It's not good for many metabolisms, you know, out there. People have different metabolisms, but a high-carb diet is not ideal for us, and our bodies need fat. Our brains need fat. We need good fat. There's, you know, some research that shows that the saturated fat in butter is actually quite a bit healthier than the saturated fat in meats because of the composition, because of metabolism. So there's lots of good evidence for supporting, you know, butter back on the table. Of course, in moderation, but I tell people all the time, you know, once you eliminate all these sugary foods that have a lot of butter, you know, like cookies and cakes and pastries, like, we know that's not healthy, right? Those are, you know, guilty pleasures that we allow ourselves now and then. But once you eliminate all of that and you have butter in this savory way, you know, on your toast, cook your fish in it, have it on your baked potato, I mean, that's a moderate, healthy use of butter that really anyone can enjoy.
Talking to Elaine Khosrova, author of Butter, A Rich History. And Elaine, your book took you all over the world, including here in Wisconsin. What did you come to Wisconsin to learn about butter?
Yeah, I mostly came to talk to your experts. I wanted to, first of all, find out about the animal anatomy that allows, you know, a cow or a ruminant animal to eat grass and weeds and shrubs and turn that into this rich, delicious milk that we make butter out of. I was really kind of, I call it like this Rumpelstiltskin effect, you know, and I really wanted to kind of understand it. So I went to the University of Wisconsin to, you know, meet some of the specialists there. There's a woman also who explained how the udder works and how important that is. And then Bob Bradley is renowned as, you know, like the butter king in Wisconsin as far as understanding the technology and the science of butter making. So I spent a lot of time with him as well, and he's a huge resource for me.
What surprised you about the way that butter is made and the science of butter?
Well, I have to say the industrial production really surprised me the most, because I discovered that one of the reasons supermarket butters and, you know, big brands have this great consistency. When you think about their texture, you know, like, it's smooth, it's velvety, it's cohesive. If you've ever made butter at home, it's really hard to get that texture. you know, it'll taste just fine. It certainly melts just fine, but it doesn't have that velvetiness. And what I discovered is in the industrial plants, they put the cream through what's called a physical ripening, this tempering process. You know, we're talking about like little shifts in temperature up and down. And what that does is it shifts the ratio of solid and liquid fats in the cream. And when you have just the right ratio of liquid and solid fats, you get this beautiful texture. You know, if you have too much liquid fat, you end up with a kind of greasy butter. And if you have too much of the harder fats, you end up with a more brittle butter. So I was kind of, that was like a big surprise to me. I didn't know that that happened. I thought, oh, they just bring in the cream and churn it, and that, there it goes. But we can be, you know, quite happy with the production they do in the big plants. It's very clean. It's very pure. It's there's no additives. It's good production, although I, you know, of course, love artisanal production, too, because it can be so interesting.
Let's dig into a recipe. You've got some in your book. One we have shared on the Central Time Facebook page. It's a dessert recipe, not one of the savory ones you mentioned. It is a butterscotch pudding. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's it's a very simple recipe, and honestly, yeah. It's one from my childhood, because I remember my mom used to make this quick dessert of a butterscotch pudding, essentially. And she sometimes put it in a pie crust and top it with some whipped cream, and it was really delicious. So I just went back and, you know, started to look at butterscotch recipes from, you know, from the 1900s, because really it's not a flavor that has been popular, you know, in this millennium. It's kind of been lost in the shadow of, I think, caramel sweets and caramel flavors. Butterscotch is slightly different. It's not cooked for as long, so it has a more sort of honeyed taste. So I love it, perhaps because it's from my childhood, but I do think it's a really nice treat.
And when we come back, we will talk about smoked butter. We're talking right now all things butter with Elaine Kozrova. She's the author of Butter, A Rich History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook a lot with butter? Do you have a favorite kind of butter? Have you tried artisanal butters? Have you ever made your own butter? How did it come out? Do you have a success story, or did it all go wrong? And do you have questions about how to cook with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post and find that butterscotch pudding recipe over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Elaine Kozrova, a food writer and the author of the new book, Butter, A Rich History.
You can join in this Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about butter, its science, history, or how to cook with it, or your favorite uses of butter? You can share those with us as well. And if you make or have ever made your own butter on a small or large scale, love to hear from you as well. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find a butterscotch pudding recipe while you're there.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jackie on the line with us in Stanley. Jackie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My question is, I just moved to Wisconsin from Washington, and there was a farmer's market out there that puts butter in their coffee. It's called Bulletproof Coffee.
Yeah, I remember that.
Butter with coconut oil. And so I was wondering if your guests had ever heard of butter in your coffee.
Jackie, thanks a lot for that. And Elaine, what about that, the butter in the coffee? I've heard about a kind with yak butter, actually, too. What do you know about that kind?
Yeah, the Bulletproof Coffee, I have heard of it. I think it's trending really, you know, a lot across the country. There's coffee shops, even in where I live in the Hudson Valley, that are serving it. From what I hear, it's meant to give you a lot of sustained energy throughout the morning. Most people have it, you know, as a quick beverage in the morning, you know, if they're not having breakfast. And what's interesting is that it comes from the tradition of yak butter tea from the Himalayas. Apparently the man who came up with Bulletproof Coffee had been hiking in the Himalayas and was really impressed by how drinking the local tea that's whisked with yak butter and a little bit of salt gave him a lot of stamina and energy and alertness. So he came back and created this mixture of butter and coffee and the coconut oil, or MCT oil. It's called medium chain triglyceride oils. I haven't had it myself. I do have friends who have it and like it. They make it in their blender every morning, because you do need to whisk in the butter, otherwise you end up with a kind of slick oil on top.
I've had hot buttered rum. I don't know if it was made right. It was hot rum with an oil slick on top.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't like it that much. Maybe there's some whisking required.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to John in Horicon. John, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, today I wanted to bring up a little thing about butter. I had once went to Madison to ask, where can I get butter that is uncolored and unsalted? I was told, well, they give you sources for unsalted butter, but you cannot get uncolored butter. There's a state law or something that all butter must be colored. And
John,
I wondered what response I had can get from that.
John, thanks for the call. So that brings up a couple of questions, Elaine. You had mentioned earlier, I mean, is butter naturally yellow in color?
It is if it's... If the animals are on pasture, generally, you know, the yellow color comes from the diet of the cows. I wanted to specify that this is about cow's milk butter, because goat and sheep's milk butter will always be naturally white. But cow's milk butter will be golden depending on how much beta-carotene is in the animal's diet, and that depends on generally how much fresh grass they're eating. The more fresh grass, the more beta-carotene, usually in the butter. I'm not aware that butter had to be colored in any particular states. I mean, there was a lot that went on, you know, during the margarine wars of the last century, when butter was competing with margarine. And so there were lots of different laws about coloring or not coloring margarine, so that it didn't look like butter. But as far as coloring butter, in general, it's not done in this country. I will say what's interesting is that of all the foods we have in our market, butter can be colored, and it doesn't have to be listed on a label. So you could have a colored butter and not know it, because it's not required to be listed on the label. That's kind of a special dispensation that butter producers get.
John, thank you so much for that phone call. And I wanted to ask you, Elaine, about why butter lends itself so well to cooking. I mean, there's almost nothing in the world that smells better than just onions sauteing in butter. And then you have French cuisine, which seems like it would not exist at all if it weren't for butter. What is it about butter?
Butter is a remarkable ingredient when you consider how its uses change with its temperature. You know, if you have a soft butter, you can cream it to make, you know, batters and doughs, cookie doughs and frostings, you know, make cakes with softened butter. But then when it's firm and cold, you can make beautiful layered pastries with it. And then when you melt it, as you mentioned, you melt it for cooking and sauces, it has a whole other contribution to, you know, what we do in the kitchen. So it's incredibly versatile, incredibly flavorful. You know, if I was like stranded on a desert island, I would just want a lot of butter with me. I could do so much, that, you know. It's really remarkable, and I think people underestimate that usually, even chefs, many chefs I know.
And when I make cookies, I realize how different the texture of the cookie is based on how much I soften the butter. When I used to microwave it and it gets liquid, the texture's not so great.
Yeah.
The colder it is, the different. What is it about butter that makes it so different at really kind of subtly different temperatures?
Yeah, it's really the saturated fats. You know, when you think of oil is the same pretty much, you know, it's kind of liquid all the time, right? But it's those marvelous saturated fats, and I'm not kidding, they are marvelous, that are responsible for, you know, much of the variety in butter's reaction to temperature. And then we use that in all these different ways.
We're talking with Elaine Kozrova right now. She's the author of Butter, A History. We're talking about butter on this Food Friday. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you like to do with butter? Do you have a favorite variety? Do you go salted or unsalted? And what about these artisanal butters that Elaine has been referencing? You can call us at 800-642-1234. And Elaine, you've sampled far and wide with butter. What did you come up with? Is there a holy grail of butter, either in big batch or artisanal, that you really think is the thing?
There really are so many wonderful butters out there. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, there was a lot of bad butter out there, I have to say, between, you know, the sanitation wasn't great, refrigeration didn't exist. You know, for most of mankind's history, there's been a lot of rancid butter, dirty butter, moldy butter. We are so blessed with many, many wonderful butters. I have to say I have some personal favorites. I love cultured butter from France, but there are some American producers, small producers now, doing beautiful cultured butters. So I also love goat butter. I've discovered one from England that's not too goaty. You can get some goat butters that are very goaty, but this one is very subtle, and you taste it, and you're like, oh, what's that? You know, it's interesting, like, just complexity that you don't quite expect. So I really encourage people to try some different butters, and especially if you put them side by side with each other, it gets really interesting.
Take another caller now. Becky is with us in Madison. Becky, hi.
Hi. So I know this is really sad news, but I'm actually allergic to dairy.
No.
I can't eat butter. I know, right?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Are you sure? Is it lactose? Because...
No, unfortunately, it's not lactose. It's all dairy.
Oh.
So I wonder if you have any suggestions, particularly for baking, for how I can skip using butter.
Uh-oh. It doesn't sound like you have great news for her, Elaine, but the best she can do. Any advice?
Yikes. Yeah, well, you know, I guess I would look at one of the really, you know, most natural vegetable oil blends. I wouldn't go with, you know, Crisco or any of the really industrial stuff. But, you know, if you look in a health food store now, there are definitely options for all the vegans out there, right? I mean, they bake things, too, and don't want to use butter. So I know the stuff is out there. I'm sorry I'm not an authority because I'm all about butter. So I apologize I'm not an authority on that. But I do think there's some much healthier choices out there for you than there ever were.
And Elaine, we want to ask you about the other recipe you gave us before we see if we have time for one last call. Smoked butter. What's up with that? I've never heard of it.
Right. I was inspired to create smoked butter because I was reading a book by Michael Pollan, and he talked about visiting this chef, this European chef who made his own smoked butter. And I was like, oh, having had smoked cheese a lot, I thought, oh, yeah, I want to try that. And I did a little research and discovered this tiny gadget called a smoking gun. You can buy it online. It's made by Polyscience. It's this little gun-like thing you held in your hand, but it shoots out smoke, and it can shoot smoke through a small tube that you basically pipe into a container. So you take a butter, doesn't have to be homemade, you know, any butter, and you put it in a container. You take about a thimbleful of, they send you little wood shavings. You light those, and then it creates a smoke that is then sucked down through the tube into the container. You put a lid on it, and you let the butter kind of bathe in the smoke for, really as long as you want. It, you know, it depends on how much smokiness you want, but, you know, 10 minutes or so. And it doesn't penetrate the butter, so it's not super strong. It's just this interesting, intriguing kind of smokiness that you get. I really like it. It's fun, especially if I'm like doing a dinner party or something.
We'll leave it at smoked butter. Thanks so much to Elaine Kozrova. We've been talking about butter and her new book. It's called Butter, A Rich History. You can still check out her recipe for butterscotch pudding over at the Central Time Facebook page, or check out today's Food Friday page over at WPR.org.
Governor Walker previewed a very Wisconsin-specific budget proposal today, calling for an investment to expand and renovate the State Fair Park's Cream Puff Pavilion to the tune of $6 million.
That announcement kicked off a debate online about the Cream Puff itself, with people lining up on either side of the question, are Cream Puffs delicious? And this was, from what I saw in the back and forth, a little one-sided. There were a couple of doubters, though.
Okay, I'm from Wisconsin, but how can this even be a question? Are cream puffs? Of course they're delicious.
There were some people who found them gross and disgusting. They didn't like the texture of the puff. I'll say when I go to State Fair, of course, I go through and get a cream puff. And they're awesome when I have. But it isn't one of those things I think of, you know, I'll randomly in the middle of the day think, you know me, I'd like a donut or a cookie now. I never randomly think I want a cream puff unless I'm in
at
the State Fair situation.
Because it has to be fresh. It's like the butter. You have to have your fresh cream, and people don't make them. They don't sit in a case. That's why they're so fresh and delicious.
True. So we're one-sided on this one. You can share your thoughts on the traditional Wisconsin State Fair-style cream puff. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on Facebook. Are you a cream puff skeptic or supporter? Probably supporter, right?
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Stay tuned.